This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran saying it's closely monitoring U.S. moves and will directly respond to any aggression. This after the Pentagon said one of its aircraft carriers will remain in the Persian Gulf. Muslims in Nigeria mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi commanders. We'll have a report from Kana. And French protesters once again hit the streets of the capital, Paris, to express anger at police violence and a recent security law. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Iraqis have held a ceremony in the city of Najaf to mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iranian General Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mahdi al-Mahandis. That event was held a day after a mass rally in the capital, Baghdad, where protesters called for revenge for the two commanders. Demonstrators also demanded the expulsion of U.S. forces from their country. Anti-America sentiment has been rising in Iraq and in the region since the Baghdad drone attack last January, which was ordered by President Donald Trump. The event was also commemorated recently across Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere. Now, Iran says it has resumed 20% uranium enrichment in the country's underground Fordo nuclear facility. Government spokesman Ali Rabi says that the operation has started. Rabi says the decision was announced to the International Atomic Energy Agency as well. And that came after Iran's parliament passed a bill that obliges the government to raise the uranium enrichment level to 20%. It also stipulates that Iran will withdraw from the additional protocol to the Non-Proliferation Treaty if the remaining parties to the nuclear deal do not fully comply with their obligations and restrictions on Iran's trade continue to remain in place. At the same time, Tehran is saying it is carefully monitoring U.S. moves in the Persian Gulf amid the presence of an American aircraft carrier in the region.
We are very carefully and consciously watching all the developments in the Persian Gulf, like I've said repeatedly in the past few days, and Foreign Minister Zarif has also tweeted the same thing. So specifically, we can see the role of certain regimes and allies of Israel in creating tensions, especially in Iraq.
Adibzadeh says that Tehran seeks no tension with any country, but it has no hesitation either in defending its rights. The spokesman said that Tehran has notified its Persian Gulf neighbors not to fall into U.S. traps. That reaction came after the Pentagon said that aircraft carrier USS Nimitz and its strike group will remain in the Persian Gulf, citing alleged threats from Iran. Well, that announcement is a reversal of an order by acting Pentagon Chief Christopher Miller on New Year's Eve that Nimitz is being pulled out of the region. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran have been on the rise since Trump ordered the assassination of Soleimani last year. The country has rejected any conflict with the U.S., but pledged to avenge the killing in due time. Founder of the WikiLeaks whistleblower website, Julian Assange, is set to be tried at a U.K. court later. On Monday, the court will decide whether to extradite Assange to the U.S. A 49-year-old Australian is accused of illegally hacking into U.S. government websites and leaking documents containing logs on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, for more on that, let's go to our correspondent in London, Ahmed Caballo. Ahmed is standing outside of that court building. Ahmed, what's going on there?
Well, there's a world-exclusive breaking news just come through. The judge has ruled that Julian Assange will not be extradited to the United States. Now, activists behind me are in tears. They've been following this case from the start, and they cannot believe it. Many people thought that this was a foregone conclusion, that Julian Assange would be extradited to the United States. He would then be prosecuted, and then would face 175 years. but to the shock of many, that has not been the case. Now, there will be an appeal via the prosecutor's office, and this will not be over. But for many, they're jubilant scenes because they cannot believe that British justice has actually served Julian Assange after he's done him so harshly since he's been detained in Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison. Now, why this case is significant is because of what it represented. If Julian Assange would have been prosecuted, it would have meant that reporting on wars, on British and American involvement in war, would have been severely impacted. It would have meant that if journalists would have reported on Apache helicopters, on predator drones, on white phosphorus bombs, on torture, on waterboarding, and many of the crimes that were committed by the United States and the United Kingdom during the British and American invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, that would have been severely impacted. But what this means today is that journalists can report on these things, and it's a hugely significant case. And like I said, not many people expected the result that's just been announced.
And Ahmed, do we know what the court verdict is? Will he remain in detention or what?
So if he's not going to be extradited, then
which
we'll
is good news, yes.
Which is good news. We all assume he'll be released awaiting an appeal. But that's all unclear. This is literally breaking news. The news has just come through around a minute ago before we went live. So more news will come out, I'm sure, as the people that are inside the court come out. But it's massive news. Like I said, it has worldwide implications because they were trying to prosecute Julian Assange under US law without the protection of the US Constitution. It was an unheard-of case, as it's never in the history of British or American law has a publisher ever been prosecuted for publishing classified material. So this case is a huge precedent, and it will have huge ramifications going forward for press freedom, not only in the United Kingdom, not only in the United States, but around the world.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Ahmed Kabbala, our correspondent live for us outside of that court, seeing into Julian Assange's extradition to the U.S. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have marked the first anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani and the Iraqi commander al-Muhandis in an event in the northern Nigerian city of Kano. Our correspondent Dejuma Abdullahi has a report.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
It's very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. He is also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against the Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing, trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, deputy head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Ranjim Abdullahi, Kano.
Now, China says it will take necessary measures this after the New York Stock Exchange began delisting three Chinese telecom firms. Chinese Foreign Ministry says that Beijing firmly opposes Washington's behavior of politicizing trade issues. The U.S. accuses China Mobile, China Unicom, and China Telecom of having military ties with the government. In November, President Donald Trump signed an order barring American investment in firms that have ties with the Chinese military. Beijing and Washington are at loggerheads over a series of issues, including U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. So far, the Trump administration has targeted a number of Chinese companies and individuals. Beijing has responded by drawing its own blacklist of U.S. companies. Now, to get some insight on that from Montreal, I'm joined by Angelo Giuliano, who is a political analyst. Let's have your opinion on this. How far will this go on, this the tit-for-tat measures between China and the U.S.?
I think this is only a of pressure on China to be cycling U.S. dollar. China is a huge trade surplus with the U.S., and the U.S. is putting pressure on China to finance its trade surplus by reinvesting into U.S. Bonds. And the trend has been a decline of overall, all around the world. A lot of countries are losing faith in the U.S. dollar, so the trend of investing to U.S. Bonds is declining. Russia has no more U.S. bonds, and China is decreasing its assets in U.S. bonds. So I think it's important to look at what is the real issue here. It's about financing the trade deficits of the U.S. And also the U.S. dollar. And the U.S. is actually who started the I would call it the tensions are China and Russia, because they started the decoupling before by starting the de-dollarization. I think this is the center of the issue. It's very important to understand that de-dollarization would mean the collapse of the U.S. economy.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Angelo Giuliano, political analyst. Now, in Paris, a protest rally has been held against police violence and the global security law. Demonstrators are urging the government there to forbid the controversial method of a knee-on-neck choke. Our correspondent has the story.
A compact group of demonstrators took the street again in Paris to protest against police violence, and in particular against the impunity of police officers who used the very controversial method of knee-to-neck choke with fatal consequences. 1 year ago, Cédric Chouviat died after 22 seconds of knee-to-neck choke that caused him fatal wounds. He died in a hospital 2 days later. Four police officers were directly involved and indicted for involuntary homicide. The family of the victim asked for their suspension.
We have asked the Interior Minister to suspend the four police officers involved in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for the suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Assa Traoré is the sister of Adama Traoré, murdered also by the knee-on-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traoré died exactly the same way as Cédric Chouviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Cédric Chouviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against the global security law that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in Paris by police officers last November was made public. The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cédric Chouviat was choked to death. Cédric Chauviat died with a knee on neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Denhant, Paris.
A leaked phone call reveals that the U.S. president has pressed the Georgia Secretary of State to overturn the 2020 presidential election results.
You know what they did, and you're not reporting it. That's a criminal offense, and you know you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyer. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard. And they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can, both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
The hour-long phone conversation between Trump and Brad Raffensperger was obtained by Washington Post. And the audio, Trump stresses his claims of voter fraud and irregularities in the U.S. state, which were repeatedly rejected by the Republican state official. Now, those claims were made as President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state has already been certified by the Electoral College. And the revelation comes days ahead of the Congress's January 6th meeting, when Biden's victory is expected to be officially certified. Some 100 lawmakers are set to contest the certification and try to change the results in favor of President Trump. Political commentator Jason Andruha says that the U.S. president's push for Georgia's officials to overturn the election results in his favor could be seen as a violation of the election interference law.
It's really ironic that Trump would actually accuse someone else of removing machines when it was he that ordered the removal of sorting machines from post offices, had mailboxes torn out of the ground in order to undermine the ability of anyone to use mail-in voting, which would overwhelmingly be Democrats. Now, the fact is, a multitude of accusations have been brought forward about the election being stolen, none of which have borne any fruit whatsoever. There's been tremendous accusations about the Dominion voting system being linked to Venezuela, which is a complete falsehood. In fact, the Dominion voting system offices are both in Canada and the United States, and essentially doesn't have anything to do with Venezuela whatsoever. This is a president that is trying desperately to hang on to his office because he knows that once he leaves, he's probably going to be criminally prosecuted for the crimes that he has committed, which would actually be a change for once for a president to actually face justice for the crimes that they've carried out. I mean, every president is guilty of tremendous crimes, not just against the American people, but against people across the world.
Well, we'll get one more piece of Trump news. The U.S. president has again lashed out at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, claiming that the agency has exaggerated the COVID-19 pandemic in the country. Following Trump's Twitter post, two top U.S. health officials disputed the claim. Infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci says that the deaths of jam-packed hospitals and stressed-out health workers are all real, while the U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams defended the CDC. Now, those comments were made as cases of the coronavirus are skyrocketing in the U.S., with daily hospitalizations marking more than a month of being over 100,000. The country has reported more than 351,000 deaths out of some 20.5 million confirmed cases. Vaccination is also underway, but the government has come under criticism for the program's slow and chaotic process. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.ifr.org/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani is a champion of the Iranian nation and of the Islamic Ummah. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 16, 2020, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the officials of Shahid Soleimani commemoration anniversary and with the family members of that great martyr.
Shahid Soleimani turned into the champion of the Iranian nation and the Islamic Ummah. What happened following his martyrdom was the first heart slab delivered to the U.S. Another one is to expel the U.S. from the region. This requires the determination of nations and the policies adopted by the resistance front. They should fulfill this duty. This slab will be a hard one. Of course, these measures are different from taking revenge on the assassin. The measures that I refer to are related to arrogance and the U.S. in their entirety. Soleimani's assassin and those who issued the order will pay the price. This is another issue in its own respect. Of course, according to a dear personality, even Soleimani's shoes are worth more than his murderer's head. And even if his murderer loses his head, Soleimani's shoes will still be worth more. This is true, but after all, they have done a wrong thing and we should take revenge against them. Both those who ordered his assassination and the assassins themselves should know that we will take our revenge in due time, at the proper time.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
This is a good meeting that has been decorated with the name of Shahid Soleimani. Therefore, I will issue pieces of advice which are very important. First of all, I wish to advise the officials of the country and our dear people to become strong. As our poet from Khorasan said, "Go become strong if you wish to have the confronts of life." From a poem by Ali Akbar Azadi Turbati. You both should become strong in the economy, in science, in technology, and in military defense. You should become strong. As long as you are not strong, the enemies will keep their greedy eyes on you. They will transgress against you. This is my first piece of advice, which is one that I have always offered. I myself will pursue the issue as long as I am capable of doing so. And as long as God gives me the blessing to pursue it, officials are not obliged to follow it. Secondly, you should not trust the enemy. This is my definitive word of advice.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
To Allah. James Bond.
On the morning of January the 3rd, 2020, the world woke up to the news that top Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani had been martyred in Baghdad by a US drone strike, killing General Soleimani and his entourage. The assassination came as Lieutenant General Soleimani had arrived in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government as part of his ongoing mission to fight terrorism in the region, terrorism that saw the Daesh group firmly in the sights of the Iranian military hero. The killing of General Soleimani was unlawful, as UN rapporteur Agnes Callamard clearly pointed out in her report following the assassination, suggesting a legal case against the perpetrators was the way forward. With the ultimate decision to perform the strike on the convoy of General Soleimani lying solely at the feet of the US president, it seems that Iran has a clear case against Trump for the charge of a war crime, as there was no justification for the killing, as confirmed in the UN report. However, the fact that the assassination took place and very little has been done on an international scale to condemn the murder, it appears to have given a green light to other nations to take illegal actions against Iran, in particular the recent example of the killing of Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, with officials stating that there had been strong indications that the Israeli regime had been involved in the attack.
Yes, certainly there has to be accountability for this violent and illegal assassination of General Soleimani. The United States, of course, has always felt that it is above the law. It doesn't have to maintain any kind of respect for international law or human rights. And that is one of the reasons that the Donald Trump administration proceeded with this assassination. However, this sends the wrong message to the world community. If the United States can get away with it, then anyone can get away with it. So this must be pursued in the international courts. It's interesting to see that Iran is doing just that.
Yet as the anniversary approaches and ultimately passes, Iran has clearly stated that it will pursue its legal duty to fight for justice for the assassination of General Soleimani, and the memory of the talented and much respected general will live on forever in the hearts of those seeking to continue his mission of making the region a safer place to live. The humiliating defeat for Donald Trump that saw Joe Biden sweep to a landslide victory is a sign of just how poor the decisions made have been perceived by the people of the US. Yet as the commander-in-chief of the US military, his decision to call the strike on General Soleimani was a decision that severely dented his international reputation. But as his last few days in office approach, US boats in the Persian Gulf have started maneuvers in the region, suggesting that Trump is looking for one last act of power prior to his departure, believing that until now, he's gotten away with his heinous acts. But for Iran, the most wicked act of all has yet to be dealt with. The assassination of General Soleimani has yet to see Iran take revenge for the murder, and is something that Iran has stated cannot be rushed and will happen in a matter of time.
I think we can say that currently Iran is taking action against the United States by pursuing this assassination in the courts. Someone must be held responsible and accountable for the assassination. Iran is going through the proper channels to do so. That is certainly one method that Iran can take to rectify this situation. The United States, on the other hand, if it's going to invade Iran, it's going to happen in the next 19 days, which is the last of Donald Trump's administration. While I don't expect things will improve greatly under a Biden administration, they will certainly improve somewhat, probably to the reinstatement of the JCPOA.
But for Lieutenant General Soleimani, the hero of people from across the region and the rest of the world, his ongoing work is being continued by devoted followers and freedom fighters from Iraq to Syria and Palestine to Yemen, and this continuation will be one of the best forms of revenge. Furthermore, with General Soleimani being a champion of fighting terrorism in the region, as well as resisting the US presence in the area, it seems that the sweetest revenge of all has been the victory over the US-backed Daesh group and the American assets in the region leaving the area, providing a safe, free, and healthy living environment for the people of the region. The Israeli regime has always prided itself on being the home of the latest cyber technology, boasting about its capabilities in both aggressive and defensive cyber warfare. However, it seems that the regime has counted its eggs a little too early, as a sophisticated hack has shown the real side of Israeli cybersecurity. The hack, which appears to have taken place over a period of months, appears to be from a source known as PagerKey, with the hackers deploying a form of highly sophisticated ransomware designed to extract high quantities of information from its target, as well as demanding £100,000 in Bitcoin to stop leaks going public. It seems that the hack targeted a cybersecurity company by the name of Portnox, which itself appears to be a major provider of cybersecurity to multiple Israeli regime offices, including Israeli aerospace industry, El Al, Bezaq, and Clalit Healthcare, many of which have direct links to the Israeli regime and defense systems. Evidence also suggests that much of the information which is threatening to be leaked contains secret information about various Israeli defense networks and companies, which, although not apparent to what exact details are involved, could see highly classified and sensitive Israeli secrets flooded into the public domain. A spokesman for another Israeli cybersecurity company, Clear Sky, announced that the damage done by the hackers has caused significant damage to the Israeli regime and has pointed the finger of blame at Iran as the origin of the attack, raising the question as to just what right does Israel have to put the onus on Iran after the acts the Israeli regime has committed on the country, including, of course, the famous Stuxnet bug, which targeted Iran's peaceful civilian nuclear program.
Even if Iranians were responsible for this latest cyber attack, and indeed the Israeli press has not ascertained culpability yet, and so it said clearly that it can't determine whether or not Iranians were involved, but even if Iranians were involved in this latest cyber attack, Israel would be in no position to complain about it, having taken the cyber gloves off, if you will, by initiating cyber war directly against Iran in 2009 and 10 with the Stuxnet sabotage cyber campaign. This was a campaign of the United States and Israel under the code name Operation Olympic Games, which was designed to destroy elements of Iran's civilian nuclear energy program.
The finger of blame has been pointed at Iran yet again, this time by the Israeli regime. Yet just earlier this month, the US also pointed towards Iran for a series of hacks that were alleged to have breached US voting procedures and officials, something that Iran denied as nonsense. But it seems that Israel is no stranger to cyber attacks themselves, with others predating the PagerKey attack. Earlier this year, more than 1,000 Israeli websites were hacked, with images of Tel Aviv in flames, warning Israel that the countdown to destruction had begun, with the Israeli building up a host of enemies due to its hostile actions around the world, from the displacement of people in Palestine to the participation of acts of state-sponsored terrorism. Is it any wonder that Tel Aviv is on the radar of multiple hackers from unknown locations? With such attacks proving that the Israeli regime is both ill-equipped to deal with attacks and too hasty in claiming to be a world leader in security-related issues, has the regime then lost its place at the top of the charts when it comes to cyber and electronic technology?
I believe that this latest hack demonstrates that truly all systems are vulnerable to potential cyber attack. And considering the fact that Israel prides itself so much on its high technology and its cybersecurity, this just proves that even the Israeli cybersecurity can be broken. And so this raises the question, why play with fire, especially when fire will be fought with fire?
There's no doubt that the hack is, and may further yet to prove, a huge embarrassment for the Israeli regime, in particular as the details of the information obtained is yet to be revealed by the hackers, and is similar in nature to a recent hack on US bodies, which the US alleged originated from Russia. Yet with allegations flying around, the priority now for the Israeli regime is to hope that the information obtained does not fall into the public domain and further shame the regime that appears to have no shame.
As the coronavirus pandemic continues to surge across the world, many countries have started mass vaccinations in an effort to bring the virus under control. From Europe to Latin America, many nations have imported vaccines in large quantities to help their people get rid of the highly infectious disease. Iran, however, has managed to come up with its own domestically produced COVID-19 vaccine. The country has now begun testing the inoculation on humans after successfully completing the initial steps, including tests on animals and obtaining necessary approvals. The human trial of the vaccine was initiated at the headquarters of executing the order of Imam Khomeini in the capital Tehran on Tuesday. A total of 56 volunteers will gradually receive injections during the first stage. The vaccine, Coviran Barakat, is named after the pharmaceutical group behind its development. The achievement comes as Iranian authorities have been critical of the U.S. for hindering the country's efforts to buy a vaccine from abroad. Many believe the Iranian-made vaccine proves the country's enhanced capabilities despite U.S. sanctions.
Necessity is the mother of invention, they say, and the Iranian people needed a vaccine. The U.S. Maximum pressure campaign denied them access to the vaccines, and so the Iranian people, their scientists, their government, had to go the extra mile to be resilient and develop their own domestic vaccine. It's a remarkable achievement, but it's the kind of thing that is an unintended consequence of campaigns of maximum pressure and hybrid warfare against countries. People learn to be self-sufficient, to be reliant, and they make new alliances with other countries in the military, economic, and political spheres, and that's exactly what Iran has done.
On Saturday, Iran's President Hassan Rouhani once again lashed out at Washington, saying its wicked activities have caused trouble for Tehran to acquire vaccines. Earlier this month, the head of Iran's central bank also slammed the U.S. administration for its sanctions, which he said have been hampering efforts to purchase the inoculation. Abdel Nasser Hemmati said Iran is prepared to purchase the vaccine through the World Health Organization, but it is unable to transfer the required money due to what he called inhumane U.S. sanctions. Hemmati, however, expressed hope that the vaccine-related transactions will be facilitated through other channels. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal in May 2018. Since then, American officials have targeted every Iranian sector with sanctions ever enforced against any nation. The U.S. economic pressure has prompted the Iranian officials to take a tactical step against such measures. Earlier this month, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, urged officials to focus on neutralizing the sanctions apart from securing their removal. The leader even cautioned against trusting the enemies and warned that U.S. hostilities toward Iran will not end once President Trump leaves office. But from the medical field to the military complex, technology, and a whole host of other fields, Iran has advanced its know-how domestically thanks to the U.S. maximum pressure campaign and sanctions.
Clearly, the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure has not succeeded in overturning the government of the Islamic Republic, and in fact has made it stronger and more resilient. And an unintended consequence of all of this maximum pressure campaign has been to force Iran and other countries under the thumb of the U.S. to become more self-reliant and to seek other trading arrangements, other military arrangements, other political alliances. And the end result is that the U.S. empire is now declining, and it will continue to decline at an ever-accelerating pace.
But the U.S. measures are not bound to sanctions alone. Washington and its allies, namely Israel, have a long history of using other evil tactics to prevent Tehran from its advancements. That includes the assassination of Iranian scientists, with Mohsen Fakhrizadeh being the latest victim of U.S. and Israeli plots. Fakhrizadeh is not the only Iranian scientist assassinated by the American and Israeli agents, and probably will not be the last one.
The U.S. and many of the G20 countries engage in regimes of economic sanctions and programs of hybrid warfare against a number of countries, with the point of bringing these countries under their control. The U.S. is an empire, and it uses campaigns of hybrid warfare, which included, for example, the targeted assassinations of General Soleimani and the nuclear scientist Dr. Fakhrizadeh. Includes economic sanctions. It includes continuing attacks in the mainstream media. It includes lawfare initiatives against the government of Iran. And it does all this in the hope of bringing down the Iranian government.
Probably they forget the fact that the advancement of a nation does not depend on one person. Eliminating icons like Fakhrizadeh will, of course, be felt for long, but will not stop Iran from going forward. The U.S. anti-Iran moves also raise questions as who is the United States really targeting by using all possible means to block a country's progress, be it hampering efforts to buy a coronavirus vaccine or anything else.
From the very start, there was no doubt that the EU would not give the British a deal that would match any of the conditions met by being a member of the EU. So when Johnson and von der Leyen announced a deal had been struck, why then did the UK hail it as a victory? But with the details yet to be fully made public, many people are labelling the deal as a sham for the British, clearly suggesting that the EU negotiators, led by Michel Barnier, stood firm to the end and made sure that the EU did not come out the loser on the deal. According to one French source familiar with the exact details of the paper and who wished to remain anonymous, it seems that the British made huge concessions, giving up many of the terms and conditions they claimed they would fight for. However, it seems that ultimately the British team had no choice but to cave in. Several days after the deal was announced, EU and British officials and lawmakers are poring over the details. The document is rumoured to be some 1,200 pages long, but once read and digested, will demonstrate just how many concessions the UK finally gave into and revealed just exactly what Boris Johnson tried to hide on announcement day.
Brexit is a disaster, an absolute disaster, and it's one that Boris Johnson is like hugely responsible for just by himself. I mean, as a journalist, he did his very best to poison the waters between the UK and the EU. He succeeded. The referendum passed, and now Britain is facing the reality, just a few days away, of a forcible separation from the continent.
What was clear from Johnson's announcement is that nothing new has come from the deal, with Britain claiming victory over its borders, freedom of movement, and trade criteria, all things that, with a deal or not, Britain would have had anyway. So where then does the victory lie for Whitehall? Johnson's next task is to win over the hardline Brexiteers, many of whom who wanted to leave the EU without a deal, claiming that Britain will be fine on its own. However, it seems that Johnson may have already convinced many to fall in line, as any sign of division now by the British would send a message to the world that the deal was in fact a disaster for the UK, a message that Britain can ill afford to leak out. The British made numerous promises prior to the announcement of the deal between Britain and the EU. Some of these promises included protecting the rights of British fishermen, farmers and businesses. Yet it seems, as details slowly emerge, not all are happy about the deal. British fishermen, for one, have already started claiming that they've been sold out by Boris Johnson as they face sharing British waters with EU fishermen for the next 5.5 years, only increasing their quota from 10% to 20%, suggesting that not much will change. But when it comes to the financial value of fishing in the UK, one has to really question the fishing industry culture. With fishing making up only 0.1% of the overall British GDP, is it any wonder then that Johnson failed to push hard for a fair deal, raising the question as to just what else he folded on?
There are several. There are the question of fishing rights, which apparently he had to give more ground than he wanted to. Which essentially gives the EU greater rights in the English Channel than British fishermen had water to grasp. The other one involves business services, and that's really quite unclear as to what will happen. The agreement is 1,200 pages long, so no one at this point is quite sure what's in it.
For Johnson, and all in favour of Brexit, a long road lies ahead before the full impact of Brexit becomes clear. But what's for sure is the level of uncertainty and division that lies ahead. For a start, Scotland will no doubt seek a second independence referendum, sparking a chain reaction that will likely see the North of Ireland request to be united with the Republic of Ireland, causing a breakup of the UK, something that seems an inevitable consequence of Brexit. From the EU perspective, Britain, it seems, is a spent force, a country living in the fading memories of past glory, and slowly but surely floating further away from Europe, something that the EU, for one, will be happy to watch sinking on the horizon.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله الله يا الله والحمد لله الله ولا إله
This is part of a speech of Imam Khomeini, the founder of Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with clergy and the students of the seminary. Man is not able to commit sins before a discerning child, and he does not expose his private parts. So how could he expose his private parts before Allah, the Exalted, and not dread to commit a crime? This is because he has faith. Human being has faith in the presence of the child. However, with regard to the divine presence, if he has knowledge, he still lacks faith. Due to the multiplicity of his sins, which have darkened and blackened his heart, he is totally unable to accept truth and may not even consider them to be likely.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio, and I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. In this program, we were talking about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini. I have a very important saying of Imam Khomeini here, and which is related to the servitude. And obviously, we were talking about being in the presence of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and to having a divine cause. Here, Imam Khomeini is talking about one of the major criteria, or we can say one of the major things because of which he was successful in bringing the revolution, because of which he was successful in his life. And that is, he says that rely on God. This reliance on God by his will solve all problems. So basically, Imam Khomeini was successful because he had tawakkul ala Allah. He relied on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum, Ya Hayyu Ya Qayyum.
You know, in the verses of Quran, we had the word the mu'mineen. The believers, they rely on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This reliance is very important because, you know, if I want to just talk about our general life, the way we live, if you have seen kids, maybe if they're very small, like 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, maybe if they are 10 years, 12 years, or even when they grow up, they need someone to support them. Whenever they have the support of their parents, they rely on their parents. So basically, we all, being human beings, we are looking for someone who is stronger than us, who is stronger, on whom we can rely. That's why sometimes we rely on our parents, sometimes we rely on our friends, maybe because they are wealthy, maybe they have more relation with the authorities, and it can be because of any other reason, but because they're more powerful than us, that's why we rely on them. Allah gave them all these powers and obviously this honor or status that they have, because Allah is the one who gives all this honor and status. So Imam Khomeini is talking about tawakkul. He says, tawakkul ala Allah, rely on God. This reliance on God by his will solve all problems. If Allah wills, everything is solved. Why? Because we have relied on Him, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Economic divide.
A year that will no doubt go down in history as one of the most memorable, and one that many actually want to forget. The arrival of the COVID-19 virus not only had an impact on the lives of the people that caught the virus, but has also torn a hole in the global economy, impacting aviation, the stock market, the leisure industry, and of course, the retail industry, which saw lockdowns really hit hard.
No restaurants,
no hotels, no cafes and cinemas and things, no tourists. That's going to have a huge impact on us this year, I'm sure. And other things is just really hoping things tick over and we can make our way through and we survive it all. I think that's the most important thing to us at the moment. We're not really looking beyond that.
Well, this year has also seen a shakeup in the corridors of the White House in the United States, with incumbent President Donald Trump suffering a landslide defeat against the president-elect Joe Biden. Yet, in spite of the results, is something that Trump and his supporters refuse to accept, claiming monumental fraud.
This has a long way to go. This has a long way to go. You're going to find tremendous fraud. You're going to find fraud of hundreds of thousands of votes per state. You're going to find fraud of many, many times the votes that I need. Again, we're not talking about less votes where, you know, 20 votes, but it doesn't turn the election. No, we're talking about thousands and thousands of votes beyond what we need to turn a state.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaba Tahwe. In this episode, the final one of the year 2020, we're going to take a look back at some of the major stories that hit the front pages throughout the year and remind ourselves of just how difficult a year 2020 was. Joining me in the studio today in this end-of-the-year special is Mahan Abedin and Atefe Khalidar. Well, many thanks for both of you for being in this end-of-the-year special. Mahan, first over to you, the main story that stood out for you for the year 2020.
Well, obviously the corona crisis, but beyond that, it's how disjointed the world is.
And for you?
I think the global market crash caused by this pandemic was one of the main events of 2020.
Everything surrounding COVID obviously has had this kind of impact. In terms of what has occurred, we're going to obviously look at COVID. Mahan and Atefe are going to be with us throughout the show as we look back on this year. First, let's take a look at our first recap, which no doubt was the biggest news of 2020. Of course, what we just talked about, the COVID-19 pandemic.
When reports started emerging from the district of Wuhan that a virus had started causing flu-like symptoms, breathing difficulties, and in some cases, death, nobody really considered just what would happen next. On December the 19th, 2019, COVID-19 was named, and the consequences have caused over 1.7 million deaths and nearly 80 million infections worldwide. Yet it was not just the human impact that caused devastation. COVID-19 brought with it one of the most difficult years in recent history. Medical institutions soon found themselves overwhelmed with the significant increase in high-demand patients, all whilst facing PPE shortages and seeing that medical teams themselves were becoming infected with the virus. But it was the impact on the economy which brought a second layer of misery to many people, with multiple companies, businesses and trades all collapsing at a rate of knots rarely seen, with national GDPs slipping by as much as 25% in some nations. The aviation industry ground to a halt, with flights cancelled, jobs lost, routes wound down, all leading to many airlines either seeking huge multi-billion dollar government bailouts or going bust altogether. With the promise of the vaccine just around the corner, what now remains to be seen is the recovery time to a return to normal. Yet with the mammoth logistical task of distributing the vaccine to over 7.8 billion people around the world, it may well be longer than we all wish for.
Time now to take a look back at one of our esteemed guests, YouTuber